Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's jump right into our week in review. And of course, the big story this week, a jury finds Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev guilty on all 30 counts. Also this week, Governor Charlie Baker's MBTA panel finds the system in need of major overhaul and sparks a debate about reform versus revenue. And as the nation absorbs the horrific images of police officer Michael Slager shooting dead Walter Scott as he tried to run away, law enforcement officials in Boston release a video to the public that they say shows a convicted felon shooting a Boston cop in the face last month. Joining us to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hello, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And Renee Loth, she's editor of Architecture Boston and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you, Renee. Thank you for coming
in. Good afternoon.
So let's start off with the conviction of Jahar Tsarnaev and the next phase of the trial, which will determine whether he gets the death penalty or life in prison. The U.S. Attorney's Office has just announced that those proceedings begin on Tuesday, next Tuesday. And I want to ask you this. Let's start with this line of questioning. Some have argued that this next phase is unnecessary. And we spoke to Cambridge attorney Harvey Silverglate yesterday, who says it's become too easy for the feds to usurp state authority in a case like this. He writes, had Tsarnaev been tried in state court, he'd already be serving a sentence of life without parole in a state maximum security prison. Here's what he told us.
It's our marathon. It's our state. It's our city. And I think it's a mistake for the feds to use their supervening power and their superior authority to do something that the people of this state have decided they didn't want done in this border, and that is impose the death penalty.
So I'll start with you, Scott. I mean, there's pushback, of course, to that state rights argument. But what do you think of Harvey's argument and as we look forward to this next phase of the trial?
Harvey is very smart, and I try always to agree with him when I can. No, I mean, that makes sense to me. I think people are queasy about the death penalty. I got to say, my objections to it are, in the main, procedural and fairness. And so this case doesn't trip any of those things with me necessarily. I think this guy did a horribly evil thing. And, you know, I'm just queasy about it. I have complete respect for people who feel like he should be executed because I think it, frankly, is appropriate, this kind of crime. But I myself in a jury, if I were part of the jury, would have trouble imposing it. So for reasons I can't really articulate, I guess. So I'm sympathetic to Harvey's argument that it would be better if we had gone the state route on this.
Mm, what do you think, Renee?
Well, I think in a way the part of the trial that was unnecessary was the first part, you know, because even the defense from the very beginning admitted the guilt phase of this trial, and now we're into the penalty phase. You know, I think that you know, I agree with Harvey. I'm very much against the death penalty personally. I think, you know, societally and in terms of where Massachusetts is, we're not in favor of this when we have life without parole as an alternative. I actually checked the Death Penalty Information Project's statistics on this, and in fact, juries do tend to go with life imprisonment almost twice as much as they do the death penalty. So, you know, this is a very heinous crime, and it's very different. It is a rise to the federal level, but I think that in Massachusetts, we'd be just as happy with life imprisonment.
Well, we're going to put a bracket around this topic at this point because later in the show we're going to be talking in some detail about the second phase of this trial. So let's move on to some of the other stories this week, including the MBTA report and the report from Governor Charlie Baker's special panel on what ails the T and how to fix it. Here's Governor Baker speaking earlier this week.
The people of Massachusetts deserve a well-managed, well-run, cost-effective transit system. Unfortunately, this report indicates that right now they do not have one.
So there's a lot in this report. I'm going to just summarize a couple of things. It calls for management reform, citing a culture of big perks and pensions and rampant absenteeism. The report also acknowledges the need for more revenue, though Baker says it would be unwise to pump money into a system before reforms are adopted. The panel also recommends higher fares and that the state assume something like $1.8 billion of the MBTA's debt that was associated with the big dig. And there are other recommendations, and we can talk about them. But Renee, I'll start with you. There have been a bunch of reports over the years about the T's woes. Is this one going to spur action and make a change?
Well, I do think that some aspects of the recommendations will be adopted. The Chamber of Commerce and other important, you know, players on the scene have rallied around this report. I want to just take a little tangent to say how much I admire the media manipulation of the rollout in this report.
The drip, drip, drip of all the leaks.
The leaks, the daily leaks for at least 3 days, which kept this report on the front page every day for 3 days, and which really kind of shut out the opportunity of opponents or, I guess, advocates for the T or for more funding for the T. It sort of shut out their ability to comment, you know. So this was really masterfully you know, sort of rolled out. But, you know, and I think the panel had a lot of useful information. We learned a lot of important things. For my opinion, the bottom line, though, that the T's problems are primarily managerial and not financial, I think that is wrong and really kind of disappointing.
Mm. But what did you see in this report, Scott? Because clearly managerial was sort of the front line. But as you read into the report, they said, but it needs money as well.
Yeah, I think prior to this, the narrative with the T has been sort of the D'Alessandro report is that, well, reform is a small thing, and really all that is required is more funding. And I think that has been kind of the narrative on the left. I disagree with that. I think you need to have both. But I think that, as I said in a column some weeks back, right now, just putting more money into the T is a little like, I think, pouring oil into a sieve. And you really do need to get at some of these very substantial problems. And I think the way the contracts work at the T, it's very hard to crack down on abuse. I mean, we saw a lot of that with the absenteeism. I think a certainly a disproportionate use of the Family Leave Act. 57 days a year is a lot of days, even as an average for people to take. I mean, you get to 35 or 40, but I think you can say, okay, but when you get to 57, you're talking a lot of time, a lot of time off, a lot of canceled bus routes because of that. One thing I think it's important to think about is Pacheco Law. I mean, when you can take your buses, put them on a flatbed truck them to Michigan, have them rehab there, bring them back, and save 30% over what you could do it locally in an MBTA garage, it tells you something's very wrong. If you could stretch your maintenance budget by 40% across the board, you really would have done something. So I think this is important as it resets the debate and said we can't just put more money in. We really need to do reforms as well.
I think it just, you know, gives a kind of a cover to legislators who don't have the guts to raise the gasoline tax. You know, they're talking about fare increases in this report. MBTA fares have gone up again and again and again. I, you know, went through the dates. You know, it was like 2009, 2011. Every couple of years, the fares go up again. The gasoline tax has been raised once in the last, who knows, 30 years, 25 years, and only by 3 cents. You know, so if we're going to be talking about, you know, a balanced transportation system that has, you know, kind of fair sharing of financing, I mean, I think that you know, putting more burden on the you know, poor traveling public is not, you know, commuting public is not the answer.
On the other hand, I guess they point out I was just going to sort of ask you about this. $2.10 for a subway ticket in Boston is lower than subway systems in Chicago and New York, for example.
Well, Chicago and New York are much better systems. Mm-hmm. I mean, New York runs all night, right? And Chicago is just a better and bigger system. So I saw that statistic. They talked about how the fares were lower here than peer systems. Well, we are not peer with New York City. And, you know, I bet that if we had a New York City quality and, you know, frequency and ubiquity of trains, that people would pay more money. But to pay more for the system we have now, I'm not buying that.
Mm. But I think the public feels that way, too, about the general funding issue until it's really cleaned up, until you have real confidence that the more money you put into it. I mean, one of the things in this report said that a lot of the capital spending they had planned and what they call a state or status of good repair, they hadn't even managed to spend that money. So they're saying, guys, we need a lot more money for this, that, and the other thing, but we haven't really been able to get the repairs we need to do out the door. So, I come back to, I do think it's very important not to think that the only solution, all that's needed here, is just a lot more funding without fixing – the bottom of the boat here. Mm. I think that's what we
Well, speaking of that, what about the idea that the panel wants future team managers to report directly to the transportation secretary? In other words, the governor would have a whole lot more say over the management of the MBTA. Is that a good idea? Would that help? I mean, having a governor with whom the buck would stop, I guess.
You could argue that either way. Mm-hmm. But sometimes what's happened here, I think, is that organizations like the T or Massport or the Pike have become sort of the previous administration hanging on in exile almost. But then you can say, well, if you let the new governor just go in and put his people in, then it becomes kind of a patronage thing for him. I guess I would favor that model somewhat because there's more accountability with voters. It's hard now to say with an agency that's controlled by the last administration's people that you're going to hold the current governor accountable. And I do think there should be some voter straight line accountability in some of this stuff.
Last word on the tea, Renee.
Oh well, I guess I was going to say that this fiscal control board that the report recommends is essentially going to delay any real investments in the transit system for 3 to 5 years while they figure out all of this, reform. And I just don't think we can reform our way out of a $6 or $7 billion backlog in maintenance and repairs. And I think we just need to do both. We need to do reform and revenue, and I'd have them, simultaneous, not seriatim.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about the latest police shooting of an unarmed black man and how this story is reverberating in Boston. And this week, the focus, of course, was on that shocking video from North Charleston, South Carolina, where Officer Michael Slager fired 8 shots and shot dead 50-year-old Walter Scott as he tried to run away after a traffic stop. Today in Boston, Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Conley released to the public a video that apparently shows a convicted felon, Angela West, shooting Boston Police Officer John Moynihan in the face after a traffic stop in Roxbury last month. After the shooting, the officers shot West dead. Here's Dan Conley today in Boston.
Releasing video evidence is something that we have done in police-involved shootings and fatalities for more than a decade. But releasing it earlier in the investigation reflects our intention to make best practices on transparency even better.
So the police had already shown this video to community leaders in an effort to keep the city calm after that shooting in Roxbury. But Renee, what do you make of Conley's decision to release this publicly today to sort of make this case that the earlier the better?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to look at each case individually. I think in this case, it was a really wise thing for Commissioner Evans to release this videotape first to the clergy and other members of the community, and now to the public, to defuse what could have been a very unpleasant or mm-hmm. even violent neighborhood backlash against the killing of Angela West. So I think in this case, it was really a smart move. I mean, the ubiquity of cameras in our society today have completely changed the calculus of all kinds of criminal investigations, but especially these excessive force by police kind of cases. And, that works both ways. It reminds me a little bit of when we first started using DNA evidence. It's a really great tool that can, both help us convict the guilty and also protect the innocent, depending on the case. But like any tool, it has to be used carefully and appropriately,
The difference, it's interesting that you bring up DNA, and I'll put this question to you, Scott, because the difference, DNA is precise. I mean, if you got DNA, you can run the test and it will tell you precisely yes or no if there's a match. Video evidence might not be so clear. So what happens when it's not so clear? And we're talking about release it, release it, release it.
I favor releasing more information, and I think people need to make judgments, and they need to. Sometimes things are very difficult; they're ambiguous, and I think people need to understand that too. I mean, I do think there are some cases probably where the police defense here always is, I felt that my life was in danger, and that you say that, and basically the DA says okay, and there's not a problem usually, and juries don't tend to convict. I think that people, I mean, that South Carolina thing, I mean, that guy undoubtedly, without that video, would have said, I felt my life was in danger. Mm-hmm. He just murdered that man. I mean, yeah. You look at what happened there. He pulled his gun. The guy was, he must have been 15 feet away when he started firing.
Barely running.
Fired eight shots and killed him. I mean, and then he seems to have been getting to set up a, so, I mean, people can make judgments when things are clear. I think they can make judgments when things are ambiguous. And I think it would improve law enforcement and the public mood if people knew that police had to wear body cams and that when there was something like this, when something like this happened, the video would be released and people themselves could make a judgment. I think it would really be a salutary thing for law enforcement and for the public.
Mm. All right.
Well, Scott and I agree for once. Very good.
You guys have been very nice to each other here. I'm very happy. Let's talk early presidential politics with the New Hampshire primary only 10 months away. I think if I did my counting correctly this morning. So this week, Republican Rand Paul kicked off his presidential campaign. He's a Kentucky senator, the son of Texas Congressman Ron Paul, the perennial presidential candidate. He's a Tea Party Republican with a strong vein of libertarianism running through his political veins. And Scott, you saw Paul in New Hampshire this week, and
yes,
wrote about him, and you suggested he made an impressive start.
I thought he did quite a good job. I mean, this is within the specific confines of his event in Milford Town Hall, because I will say, you know, he had some problems in some of his interviews, and there were controversies that you know, people try to kick up a lot of stuff. You know, I say that you got to judge these guys, I think, in the early going, not necessarily is this someone I myself would vote for, but how is he doing inside the context of the universe he's trying to appeal to. And I think that from the crowd I saw there, the people I talked to, there's some real interest in him, and not from the, you know, the kind of somewhat kooky crowd that sort of gravitated to his father's events. There's some people there who are, and they would sit here in the studio with us, and you say this is a person with different opinions than mine, but very kind of, you know, conservative, mainstream, interesting person. And he had a lot of people. I mean, I talked to quite a few people like that. I said, this is not your father's libertarian necessary.
Right.
So,
and Renee, libertarianism works in New Hampshire to a point. What do you think? What do you make?
Yeah, I think he's very popular, and I think he's a triple threat. I mean, I really feel that he, you know, he represents a point of view that resonates in New Hampshire, in Flinty, Live Free or Die New Hampshire. Also, he appeals to young people with his kind of live and let live libertarianism. And he generates excitement and kind of new ideas in a party that really could use them. So I think that in New Hampshire and in the rest of the, you know, campaign, he's going to be someone to really contend with. I mean, the question, as Scott says in his column, is whether he can sort of harness, you know, the good parts of libertarianism and, you know, carve out the sort of kooky parts.
Right.
That's going to be the question.
All right. Meanwhile, we're hearing that Hillary Clinton could announce her candidacy for the presidency as early as Sunday. So that makes Paul, Clinton and Ted Cruz the formally announced candidates. More will follow, no doubt. Quick word from both of you on where this race is, what you're looking forward to as we move closer to the primary.
Well, I mean, about Hillary, I mean, this is not exactly the Dance of the Seven Veils, is it? I mean, you know, it's sort of hard to see where the mystery and, you know, suspense is here. I guess I'm glad to see that, you know, we finally do have a field that's shaping up, and, you know, she's releasing her announcement on social media to show that she's, can appeal to young people, and you know, I think I think it's going to be good to have a campaign that's starting to gel.
What do you think, Scott?
I saw somewhere that she had 30,000 people helping her come up with her economic plan. Not 30,000, but I mean, it was a huge number of
thousands.
People.
Right.
I just wish Hillary could be less controlled, less cautious, and kind of just get out there and say, hey, this is who I am, this is what I believe, but I don't think there's a chance in hell it will happen. Yeah. I think she's too, the Clintons are obsessed with control. She's a front runner. It's a big organization. I think it'll be cautious. I think she will have a real challenge will come from somewhere. I don't quite know where at this point.
Well, one of the challenges, or I don't want to say challenge, but one of the big sort of questions that I'm most looking forward to covering, I guess, as a journalist, is the Bill factor. I just think that's going to be fascinating, sort of how he is folded into that campaign and where he is. Okay, let's move on. We've got just enough time very quickly to do our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold. Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, speaking as we were a few minutes ago about Rand Paul, he became this week the first candidate for president to accept bitcoins, the virtual currency, as campaign contributions. You can make a donation of up to $100 in bitcoin to Paul's campaign. You know, I think that it may seem that it's just another part of his quirky, edgy, libertarian approach to government, but there are real concerns about Bitcoin, you know, because they are essentially untraceable. This is part of why they're popular with some not so legitimate businesses. And it just, I think it raises some, if this takes off as a trend, which I see that it could, I think that it will raise questions about, you know, transparency and whether this will just become another way to get around our already pretty weak campaign finance laws.
Interesting. Scott.
Renee's and my friend Steve Kirchin has written a book I think everyone's probably heard about called Master Thieves, about the Gardner Art Museum heist. But in it, we all know how badly the FBI has screwed some other things up here in Boston. In it, Kirchin makes a very good case. He presents a very plausible theory about what happened, apparently one that the FBI hasn't really investigated fully. And read the book. It's really well done, and the theory, I think, is eminently plausible and backed up. It's not just a theory. It's a source-based theory, let me put it that way.
Okay, really interesting, intriguing. We've got to get him on this show and talk about that.
Yeah, you should. You should.
All right, so here's my hubbub. You were talking about Bitcoin. I'm talking about real coins, and here's the figure. $13,513. That's the amount of loose change that travelers left at the TSA checkpoints at Logan Airport. This comes from Boston.com. So, you know, a little bit of change adds up. Here's the figure nationally: $674,000, $674,841 nationally. That's people leaving their change in those little boxes before they go through security. Think of how many tickets to Disneyland all that change would buy. So there you go. All right, that's it. Scott Lehigh, Boston Globe columnist, and Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you both, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, if juries speak on our behalf, what should the jurors decide on whether Jahar Tsarnaev should live or die? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.